right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. This is one of those shows that I'm really, really both excited and anxious to do. There's a lot in here that I think you're going to get a lot out of, and it's going to be a whole different kind of a show for a lot of you. At the back end of the show, we will be talking with Lupillo Rivera. And Lupillo is a Mexican music superstar who stood up against the howling fascist mobs in Murrieta, that mob that was terrorizing busloads of immigrant children at the Border Patrol station out there as these children were waiting to be processed and prosecuted, I guess, actually, in turn persecuted for daring to cross the border in order to stay alive, all right? So that's the back end of the show. And at the middle of the show, we're going to be talking with Nicole Guerra. Now, back in October 22nd in 2013, a 13-year-old boy named Andy Lopez was shot 7 times by a Sonoma County sheriff. He died, and just recently, just about a week ago or so, they decided that they weren't going to prosecute him, that he didn't do anything wrong. And Nicole is an organizer with a group called Andy's Youth, which is a bunch of Andy's school friends and neighborhood friends who've come together to stand up against this and to demand justice for Andy Lopez, all right? And opening the show up, I'm really, really pleased to bring you this segment because I've watched this film 2.5 times, okay? And really, really enjoyed it. I just got so much out of it. And it was both laughing, crying, going along for a ride that was just the ride of a lifetime. And it's from director Mark Levinson and producer David Kaplan. And it's called Particle Fever. Now, their website talks about it this way. Imagine being able to watch as Thomas Edison turned on the first light bulb or as Ben Franklin received his first jolt of electricity. For the first time, a film gives audiences a front row seat to a significant and inspiring scientific breakthrough as it happens. Particle Fever follows 6 scientists during the launch of the Large Hadron Collider, the startup of the biggest and most expensive experiment in history, pushing the edge of human innovation. And as they seek to unravel the mysteries of the universe and to recreate the conditions that existed just moments after the Big Bang and find the Higgs boson, potentially explaining the origin of all matter, they confront an even bigger challenge. And we'll get into that as we talk, all right? Because that challenge is actually, what actually happens? Do you ever reach a limit in understanding why we exist? And that's an incredible, incredible subject matter, really broad, really expansive. And joining us to talk about this today is Mark Levinson. Mark is a physicist turned filmmaker, and David Kaplan is a professor of theoretical particle physics at Johns Hopkins University. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Okay. Yes, we're going to jump into this. David, every time I think of you, I think of the ironic remarks that you make throughout the film that made me laugh and then also jolted my brain. It was like sort of somebody tickling me and then all of a sudden sticking a hot prod into my brain, okay? It was like, whoa, wait a minute.
Sorry about that.
No apologies. It was great, which maybe says more about me than anything else. Anyway, let's start off with an explanation of the basic story of the film. I gave a tiny explanation, but what actually is this film about? What's the Large Hadron Collider experiment? Explain a little bit about all of that. I don't know, David, why don't you start on that?
Yeah, the Large Hadron Collider is an experiment. It's an enormous experiment. It's a 16.5-mile-around ring that is about 300 feet underground. It crosses the French-Swiss border, and it is at a lab called CERN, which is a center for particle physics in Europe. The acronym doesn't work anymore. But CERN has been there for 50 years, 60 years actually, just looking at the basic laws of physics, trying to understand what matter is and what are the properties of matter and the properties of space-time. And the purpose of this specific experiment, the LHC, was to push deeper into that knowledge. And one of the things they hoped to have found, and they did find, was the Higgs boson. That is a particle that gets added to the short list of fundamental particles that make up all the dynamics of fundamental matter, how matter works, why atoms exist, and properties of space-time to allow it to exist. And to do that, they reproduce, in a sense, a tiny fraction of the conditions that existed at a very, very early point in the universe when all these particles were bouncing around, smashing into each other. And by reproducing that little image way back at that point at very high temperatures, you get a better broad sense of the laws of physics and the rules. And those underlying rules tell us a lot about what we are and what matter is.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mark, this is an idea that David went into pitch as a film idea, and the money people just weren't interested in it. But they told you about it just, I guess, in passing is the way I read about it. And you said, wait a minute, that's a really cool idea. I'm going to do this. I want to get in touch with these people. I want to try and do this. What made you think that there was something in this film in particular that was really going to be a lot of fun to do, that you could be passionate about, and that you would make a real difference in the world?
I actually started my film career by getting a PhD in theoretical particle physics. So in some ways, it may have been a very unintended destiny. But, you know, why I thought it was going to be exciting was for all the reasons why I originally got involved in physics. I knew that this was an incredible field, particle physics. You're contemplating the most basic fundamental elements of the universe and how it works. But after I got my PhD, I moved into filmmaking, and I had been in the narrative film world, fiction world, had not seen very good depictions of science and scientists and the scientific process, and certainly nothing that captured the incredible excitement of this field. And so I had always thought that, you know, I hoped there might be some way to make a film that combined these two strands of my life. I thought I would maybe write a script about something and some scientists. And then when I heard about this, realized that this was a monumental event, and when I contacted David, found that he was also not interested in doing a typical science documentary, but we wanted to do something that was completely different in terms of capturing the real process, the real lives of the characters and what was going on. And so to me, it was the perfect combination of these things. And I, you know, as a storyteller, I could see the potential for a good dramatic story. Of course, we had no idea that it would turn out to be way more dramatic than we expected. And that's the nature of documentary. And we were, you know, once I signed on, just was along for the ride wherever it went.
Well, and it went really great places, high, low, all over the place, and really zeroed in on some stuff that I thought was extremely important, including one thing in your whole approach to this. I mean, there's an element, a very important element of, through the whole thing, of really popularizing science, you know, and I thought that was extremely important. And you know, in line with, you look at things like, you know, the original Cosmos series, you look at the things like the renewed Cosmos series, you look at you know, all the various people that have been out there over the last few decades trying to really hit at popularizing science in a way that would make people understand that this is actually a fundamental part of the human experience. Even if you don't understand it all, you can understand it. And I thought there was a lot you did in the film that really was unique, including actually giving people a sense, an inside look at working scientists and what is their work consist of and what are they like, which was really important in terms of how they approach the world.
Yeah, no, I think that was very important. And I think, you know, all these other shows, I mean, the Cosmos shows, the, you know, Brian Greene's shows, I mean, they're all great. And I say what I think the difference is that those shows, they try to get you excited about the wonder of science. And what we hope with Particle Fever is it will make people want to actually do it.
Yes. In fact, I went out and tried to build a lab in my yard right after this. But the dogs ate it real quick. I don't know what's the matter.
You didn't scribble any equations on a board?
I'm getting to that point. And actually, we'll talk about that. I was like more on the experimental level, but then I thought, maybe theoretical would be interesting too. But let me ask you this too, because part of the approach that you have in this film, I'd like to hear from you and David, and maybe David, you can speak to this first, but part of the approach here is there's a kind of polemic, if you will, including on how and why these kinds of projects are tackled. You've talked about this being the biggest experiment, physics experiment in the history of humanity. I mean, this is a huge, huge thing. And it's not just because it's got these giant things out there, all this stuff that's out there, which is really remarkable when you see it in the film. It's just going to blow your mind, folks. But there's, you know, you talked about these kinds of projects that are very important in terms of they take people really beyond the borders of where you think your limitations are. And I thought there's a polemic in there of how, and that waged in a very good way, of why these kinds of projects are tackled and what you do when you're confronted with the unknown.
I think in a historical context, you have to look at what this is as a continuation of 400 years of attempting to discover what reality is. What is physical reality, and how is our interpretation of it flawed in terms of actually making predictions about the future, what it is, how we got here, what it's made of? And it quantitatively started with Galileo and Newton, and it's continued to now. So in a sense, this is just a continuing process with whatever is going on in the world politically, sociologically. This is just something that's always been luckily in the background. It's a testament to humanity that we actually do this and we continue to do it. The guise you see it in now is through the lens of what modern day world is and international politics and science funding and all these things. But this is a very old process and procedure, and you're right. What it does is it hands us something which is pure knowledge. And you can, in economic terms, you can call it a public good. Once we know these things, they don't go away. And I think that it is really important for humanity in the broadest of contexts. What is this going to build us? Is it going to make computers faster? Does it cure disease? Is it? No, not, at least that's not why we're doing it. We're going after it for very pure reasons, for pure knowledge, and it's something that's a gift to the entire world once it comes. If it becomes useful for something, okay. But this is truly what is around us, and what's more exciting than exploring the world we live in? And this is one way of doing it. And this way gives us some very deep insights about how we got here in the first place.
You know, and it gives some very deep insights as well to the nature, not, as a friend of mine said, not human nature, but the nature of humanity in terms of actually the constant seeking to understand the world as it is around you and as it's changing, and actually acting to change it as well based on what you understand. It's an incredible argument in that direction.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you. Pardon me?
It changes me. It's had a profound impact on me.
How's that?
I approach the rest of my life differently. The deeper I go into science, the broader perspective I have on what life is. Something that a number of popularizers like to say in different ways is that we are just physical manifestations of the laws of physics. We are coming out of the stuff that makes up the entire universe, and we're governed by the laws that make those up. And so in a sense, we're a tiny fraction of the universe that's exploring itself. We're a manifestation such that is complicated enough that we are now looking back at ourselves. So in a sense, we are part of the entire universe, and we happen to be a very particular part, which is sentient and can explore the rest of it.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Mark Levinson, a physicist turned filmmaker, and David Kaplan, a professor of theoretical particle physics at Johns Hopkins University. And we're talking about their film, Particle Fever, which is a tremendous film. And I'm going to tell you all about how you can see it at the end of this section of the program. But really, you got to go see it. Whatever you got to do, don't miss this. Mark, tell me this. You know, one of the things that was really interesting in relation to showing people an inside look at the working lives of scientists, the role of collectivity was astounding in this. And I thought both in terms of the numbers and who, but also the way that people work together without ego to try and solve problems, which was really, I think, a very important aspect of this.
No, I think it is. And I think it's something that a lot of people don't realize. Well, certainly nobody realizes the scale that this is at. I mean, you know, it's 10,000 scientists around the world. I mean, the experiments themselves, you know, we focused on the Atlas experiment. The CMS experiment is a comparable size. You know, each of them have between 2,000 and 3,000 scientists working on it all over the world. They're working on this enormous, enormous piece of equipment that has so many components that are very specialized, and nobody really understands all of the components. So they're really dependent on that. But then there's also this whole other branch of the physicist, which is the theorist. And I think that that's something that people outside of the field don't realize, that there is a distinction. Everybody in the field knows it, and it's very crucial. And I think it's a fundamental fact of particle physics that is absolutely necessary. And these two different camps, the theorists who are coming up with a theory, so working at the blackboard, coming up with ideas of how the universe works, actually have to interact with the experimentalists to verify or actually get indications of how the theories might be modified. And there's a very interesting dynamic that goes on there. And I think that's one of the main things we wanted to bring out in the film as well, that, you know, that there is this necessary interaction. They need each other, even though they sometimes work in complete, you know, almost as if they're in completely different universes. And then even within that, I think within the theory community, I mean, the stereotype is the theorist, you know, is the sort of isolated genius sitting there just coming up with equations. But what we show is that there's actually a lot of interaction there as well. There's a lot of dynamic interaction and discussion and argument. It's a very hard pursuit, and you need a lot of brains working on it to make progress.
Mm-hmm. David, what do you have to say about this relationship between the theoretical and the experimental physicists?
Well, this is a sort of newish situation. Things have just gotten so complicated that we have to split it up. So you become an expert in one or the other. The theories require a pretty deep level of mathematics, and the experiments require a deep or broad understanding of basically everything from plumbing to computing to data analysis, as well as particle physics. So the division has to be there, and because of it, I think we've adopted very different attitudes towards the physics world or towards science, both necessary. So we have a nice, healthy suspicion of each other. And the experimentalists, as a sort of consequence, when they were first saying hints that the Higgs was there or something was there, the theorists all decided that it was there. They decided they already knew what the number was, and they were already going off, they, meaning me, writing new theory papers, assuming the Higgs has already been discovered. Whereas the experimentalists, even on July 4th, when they had five sigma evidence, they were cautious to say they discovered something. It may be the Higgs, but we don't know. And even 9 months later, they were only willing to say it was a Higgs-like particle. So these different attitudes are both incredibly important. You need this very loose, limber creativity, and then you need the rigor of both the mathematics and experimental verification for all of this to work.
Mm-hmm. And then you've talked about in the film, you talked about, and it was shown, you know, there's also, you have the relationship between the theoretical and the experimental physicist, and then you have the kind of struggle. And I have to tell you, folks, this is a film that keeps you sitting on the edge of your seat, even though you know what they're going to find in some way at the end of it. Those of you who've paid attention to what's developing in the scientific world and the world in general, you're aware of where things are going to end up to a certain extent. But there's actually this real sort of edge of your seat thing, motion to this film. And David, you had one of the things you talked about a lot in there is the difference between what was at stake there? What was at stake with finding Higgs, the Higgs particle? What was at stake there? And you talk about there was a debate between whether the universe is beautiful and ordered or a chaotic multiverse, and that this had repercussions that went way beyond anything that one might immediately see in front of them.
Absolutely. The core reason why I wanted to make the film in the first place was that I saw this dichotomy, and I saw that we were all freaked out about what was coming. And what was coming was, we had basically, the theorists had spent our entire careers speculating what is the underlying theory beyond what's called the standard model particle physics. Standard model particle physics is a list of particles and how they interact. Some of them are parts of the atom, and some are other things, which only last tiny fractions of a second, so we don't interact with them very much. But the standard model has been the theory since the 1960s, and there was only one particle left, which was the Higgs. There were deep mysteries about this theory, and we thought, well, those deep mysteries should be solved by a deeper theory, some deeper mathematics, more structure, more symmetry, something more beautiful that can explain those things. What is most of the universe made of? Why are particles the masses that they are? A number of questions which maybe sound esoteric or simple, but should be answered by the most fundamental theory that it describes nature. So we've been on this warpath to get that, but there has been speculation for a number of years that maybe the laws of physics themselves are not immutable. Maybe they are just a manifestation of where we live. Another way of saying it is that you could marvel at the fact that the Earth is in this amazing position that it could support life. It's not a few percent closer to the sun or a few percent farther away. It's right where it needs to be at the right angle, spinning the right amount with the right plate tectonics and the right atmosphere to support us. What a miracle it is that that exists. Of course, now we're discovering that there are many, many planets out there, that it's very likely almost every star in our galaxy has one or more planets, and that's 100 billion stars. And we're one galaxy of 100 billion galaxies in our observable universe. So the chances that there would be a planet in the right spot with the right conditions are incredibly good. So we don't try to come up with deep theories to explain why the Earth is exactly where it is, although that's something that people were doing 500 years ago. Now, we say that this is just a historical accident. Now, the question is, when we measure laws of physics, there's this fundamental particle, there's this fundamental force of nature. Are those things telling us about the deep, directly the deep theory of everything? Or are they just manifestations of this universe or this part of the universe? And if so, some of the numbers we measure may simply be random. And some of the particles we measure may be random accidents of things that appear in our universe, which means they are no longer clues to the deeper theory. They are just dead ends. In other universes, the laws of physics may be different. Why do we live in this universe where the laws are such that we have stars and galaxies and planets and people? Where else would we live? We're not going to grow up on a planet which is deadly, and we're not going to grow up in a universe that has no structure. We're going to grow up in a universe that has all the laws necessary. So we're unfortunately biased by our own existence, because it's required that we exist in order for us to be here to study these things. But if the laws of nature can be different in different places, we're going to only live in the place where we can live, where structure does exist. And so whenever we measure something at these colliders, now we're starting to think, are we seeing something fundamental, or are we just cataloging? As Rutherford used to say, you're either doing science or you're stamp collecting. And that's the question that we're asking. Are we on to something fundamental, or is it a dead end?
Uh-huh.
And I would caution to say that we are never going to be, I don't think, at a dead end, this is all we can learn, that's it. But certainly for our generation, we may have come to a place where we don't know where to go next, and we won't have the tools to facilitate the next discoveries. We won't know without lots of exploration, but it may just be a generational thing. And that's an emotional context for a film more than anything else.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Mark Levinson, a physicist turned filmmaker, and David Kaplan, a professor of theoretical particle physics at Johns Hopkins University. And we're talking about their film. Mark is the director, and David is one of the producers of the film. The film is Particle Fever, a really great film you can't miss, all right? Mark, let me ask you this. The music in the film, and I'm going someplace with this because the music was, I kept looking and I thought, wow, this is like something that just captures the both the enormity of the project and of the quest that's been undertaken there, and the sort of the minutiae in a certain way that actually, but it gives it the right amount of grandeur and import. And I was really moved by that, including actually with the physics rap, which folks, you have to see the film to see that physics rap. You don't want to miss that either, okay? But I wanted to ask you this, Mark. The music, all the rest of this, it's part of a theme that actually comes out through the film. It runs throughout the film. It's the overlap or interpenetration of science and art, which is sort of counterintuitive when you think, you know, if you don't think about it a whole lot, it's sort of counterintuitive. But you bring out that there's a lot of similarities between physics and art. Can we talk about that a little?
Sure. Well, this was something that was a very important element to try to convey in the film for me personally. I mean, as somebody who went from physics into art, in a sense, and something that many people see as this very strange discontinuity. But for me, I, you know, even at the time was already seeing parallels. And you know, what I say is that I think I began to feel that, you know, we are, in some sense, it's all about man trying to represent the world around him. And, you know, in physics, in science, I mean, you know, you're using mathematics as a language, but you're trying to come up with a symbolic representation that somehow is simple, but encapsulates a lot more. And that's a similar process in the arts. I mean, you may be using words in poetry, or you could use painting, or a bunch of images in a film that you somehow put together and in a way that gives a representation of the world, that helps us understand the world, understand our place in the world. And so it was always something that I was very interested in somehow conveying, and then we discovered organically how to incorporate it, and then I was given this great gift when Nima himself actually started talking to me about the Herzog film, Cave of Forgotten Dreams. And he had gone to a special screening, and he started talking about this, and this idea of the connection that he felt to these people, the very earliest people, the first people who had this idea of symbolic representations. Somehow, you know, what made some caveman decide that, you know, he should draw something on a cave that represented the world around him? And this was a fundamental step that continues to today. And so it was something that I was very happy to bring out. And of course, you know, we tried to use all the tools of filmmaking, including the music, of course, to tell a story. I mean, I think that's one of the things that appeals to me about film in particular as an art is that you get to use images, I mean, photography and words and music all in the course of trying to tell an important story. And I'm very excited that you like the music. Our composer, Robert Miller, was extremely enthusiastic. He does a lot of science things. It was a long process, and getting it just right was something that was important. We didn't want, you know, something that was just a typical sort of score, but something that also conveyed emotionality, but also something capturing what we felt was the right sound.
Mm-hmm. David, let me ask you this. You know, you talk about in the film, it's very interesting here because in the film itself, there's some very important things in terms of the scientific method, in terms of, you know, how you approach the world, how you look at reality and truth, and including the view of failure. And when you go up against it, if you do all this stuff, you find out all along that, well, everything we knew was wrong, but now you know the truth about what you originally thought. And there's somebody else I think that was in, I can't remember who it was. Well, David, was it your mentor that said the key to success is failure, being able to do failure after failure with undiminished enthusiasm?
Yes,
which I thought caught something because, and I think it's linked to a comment you made which said, in exploration, you need a set of people with no rules. Let's talk about that a little.
Sure. I think, you know, scientists get into a lot of trouble because when they talk about science, theories, or whatever is happening, they do it very cautious sounding. They don't commit. They say, this might be true. This is likely to be true. They don't like to say, this is just true. And it's because we're really always on the path of trying to show that the last theory was a failure. We're trying to figure out what is wrong with our description of the world. We'll never, probably never, have the perfect description. And the only way to make progress is to poke holes in the description we have. And we've been doing it for so many years, hundreds of years, that our descriptions are so incredibly good, it becomes incredibly difficult to poke any holes and to find the deeper theory. And so you really do have to get used to failure. And the process is really lives around failure. When I come up with an idea, I think about it. I think, can it really work? Does this work? Get excited about it. And I immediately start sharing it with other physicists. And their immediate reaction, if it's interesting, is to try to tear it apart, to tell me that I'm wrong, or no, it must have been done before, or it's obvious for some reason. And we all try to poke holes in it. So the process is, in a sense, looking for failure constantly. And when you can't get it, you put all your might into trying to killing something, and you can't, and your colleagues can't, and the greater community can't, then it's exciting. Then you're onto something. But only then. There's a morality to doing science, which is you have to be incredibly honest, honest with yourself, honest with the community, and you have to be incredibly rigorous about every step you do. And this is, for me, this is a beautiful way of living in general, but it is absolutely necessary in doing any sort of science.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I saw an interesting quote recently. I think it was by Whitehead, and he was talking about the fact that in philosophy, when you come up with a contradiction, that's the end of your argument. But in science, when you come up with a contradiction, that's the beginning of a whole new approach. And I thought it was very interesting about the way it, you know, the difference, and echoing what David was just saying too, is you're looking for failure, not failure. It's not a failure. You're looking for something that is wrong that tells you how to go forward.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that really got me too is you guys in the film, David, you spoke about this as well as a number of other scientists talked about it, the fact that nature is talking to us. And I thought that was really an incredibly interesting approach to things. And Mark, I want to ask you as the last question. David talked about how he was changed by this film. How about you? How did this film, working on this film and this film itself, change you?
Well, I think that for me, I mean, there were many levels in some sense. And, you know, reconnecting to physics at the most obvious level, I think, you know, I had sort of moved into the film world. But I think moving again in this community, it reawakened the excitement that I felt and my awe at what we have done as humans in this field. And I think in some senses has catalyzed perhaps the direction I'm going to go in, even with future films, of you know, trying again to talk about this story, to talk about the parallels between art and science, these two things that, as you said, may not even be obviously similar, but I think needs to be pursued regardless of practical applications. And so I think that's the message that film, art, science, these things that are least necessary for our survival are the things that we need to pursue. And I hope that guides my future choice and my future projects.
Me too, man. All right, Mark, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
Sure.
Thanks for the enthusiasm for the film.
Sure. David, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay. Talk to you guys again soon. Let me know what the next big project you work on. Give me a call. Okay. All right. Talk to you guys later. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. And we've been talking with Mark Levinson, the director, and David Kaplan, the producer of a film, Particle Fever. As you've heard, a really great new film. Particle Fever is available now on iTunes, and it will be available on video on demand and be able to download it everywhere starting July 15th. It's also playing in theaters. To find out where it's playing, go to their website, particlefever.com. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Nicole Guerra from Andy's Youth about the savage police murder of Andy Lopez and the whitewashing of the whole thing.
I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I had confessed to myself all along, chaser of life, poetry, trends, that awareness, consciousness, poems that screamed of pain and the origins of pain and death had blanketed my tablets, and therefore my friends, brothers, sisters, in-laws, outlaws, and besides, they already knew. But Brother Torres, common ancient bloodline Brother Torres, is dead. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I had said I wasn't going to write no more words down about people kicking us when we're down, about racist dogs that attack us and drive us down, drag us down, and beat us down. But the dogs are in the street. The dogs are alive, and the terror in our hearts has scarcely diminished. It has scarcely brought us the comfort we suspected. The recognition of our terror and the screaming release of that recognition has not removed the certainty of that knowledge. How could it? The dogs, rabid, foaming with the energy of their brutish ignorance, stride the city streets like robot gunslingers and spread death as night lamps flash crude reflections from gun butts and police shields. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. But the battlefield has oozed away from the stilted debates of semantics, beyond the questionable flexibility of primal screaming. The reality of our city, jungle, streets, and their Gestapos has become an attack on home, life, family, philosophy, total. It is beyond a question of the advantages of didactic niggerisms. The motherfucking dogs are in the street. In Houston, maybe someone said Mexicans were the new niggers. In L.A., maybe someone said Chicanos were the new niggers. In Frisco, maybe someone said Orientals were the new niggers. Maybe in Philadelphia and North Carolina, they decided they didn't need no new niggers. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this, but the dogs are in the street. It's a turnaround world where things are all too quickly turned around. It was turned around so that right looked wrong. It was turned around so that up looked down. It was turned around so that those who marched in the street with Bibles and signs of peace became enemies of the state and risk to national security, so that those who questioned the operations of those in authority on the principles of justice, liberty, and equality became the vanguard of a communist attack. It became so you couldn't call a spade a motherfucking spade. Brother Torres is dead. The Wilmington 10 are still incarcerated. Ed Davis, Ronald Reagan, James Hunt, and Frank Rizzo are still alive, and the dogs are in the motherfucking street. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I made a mistake.
All right, welcome back. That was Gil Scott-Heron and Jose Campos Torres. And this is Ain't It Still the Same? It's still going on. Yeah, it is still in the streets, and they're still doing this. They're still doing this savage, savage torture and degradation and killing of people based on their color, their nationality. And this has got to be stopped, all right? Last October 22nd, ironically, the day of National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality, the criminalization of a generation, Andy Lopez A 13-year-old young man, a young boy basically from Santa Rosa, California, was walking along a rural road with a BB gun. When a Sonoma County Sheriff's car pulled up, within seconds a deputy opened fire, pumping 7 bullets into the body of this young Latino. Now, thousands of people have been protesting this cold-blooded police murder. On July 7th this year, the Sonoma County DA issued a report blaming Andy for his own death and refusing to put the deputy on trial. Joining us to talk about this is Nicole Guerra, an organizer with Andy's Youth, who are friends of Andy Lopez and other local youth who continue to protest his killing. Nicole, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Andy and how they killed him and who he was and how they killed him?
I've known Andy since he was about six years old. My son, I have a 14-year-old son, and him and Andy have grown up together since they were in kindergarten. And he is the most loving kid you can even imagine. He is funny. You know, if someone was down, he would put a smile on their face. He knew how to, you know, make people laugh and smile and turn their moods around. And that's what he did with all his friends. He was always, you know, cheering them up and just there for them. So for on the day that he was taken from us, on the October 22nd, that hit these kids so hard. It was their friend, someone they knew they can count on to help them through a hard time, was gone. Mm-hmm. Was ripped out of their life. And that was when they all came together and decided they were all going to stand up together for Andy.
And that's
what they've been doing all this time, is standing up for Andy. They've been the ones that have been Andy's voice through all this. And they plan on continuing to be his voice until justice is served, until we do get justice, until there is justice for Andy.
They formed a group that is called Andy's Youth. What exactly is Andy's Youth? Who's in it? And this came out of like the struggle that they've been doing for a long time around this, as you're saying, of demanding justice for Andy. What's Andy's Youth and what kind of activities are they taking up?
Andy's Youth is basically all of his close friends and any kids that want to be involved. They have ideas or, you know, they want to participate. Any kids are welcome. Anybody's welcome to join Andy's Youth. They do fundraisers. They've done a yard sale in the past. But the biggest thing is they come up with ideas to march and protest, picket. The coalition, because I'm also one of the members of the coalition, we ask the kids, you guys want to march? Okay. For me, I come to them and I tell them, okay, I help guide them. You guys want to march? Okay. Well, the first thing I ask them is, why are you marching? What are your points? Where do you want to go? What is the significance of going there? And at first, it was to throwing those things out there to these kids because that's what people are going to be asking them. And I didn't want them to get torn apart by media or, you know, other community members that aren't so supportive of it. It was to get them to start thinking, okay, well, we want this, and so we're going to the DA's office. We want an answer. Okay, well, good. We got that part taken care of. And so as the process kept happening, they got better and better and better, and they were able to start setting their own ideas out there and their own demands. And they've gotten really good at it. That they're going to be able to use throughout their life are these skills that they're getting right now, speaking skills and all of this. And they're able to stick up for Andy and be his voice.
Well, one thing people should know is that these youth were actually, a lot of them were in sort of middle school themselves when they began this whole fight, right?
Right.
We have a
handful of, see, now they're going into eighth grade, and the majority of them are going into ninth grade, and we have a couple kids that are in high school.
Now, for them protesting, they have also been on the receiving end of some pretty horrendous stuff from the police there, right?
Right. We've had one of our other adult organizers, which is Louie, he's had a really hard time with it. Police are just attacking him left and right. And one day he had the kids to go put up signs for a yard sale. And they ended up attacking him and the kids that he had with them, throwing them on the ground and really beating them up. They had them for, I think it was like 3 hours in handcuffs. I now take the girls to their different appointments for back. They have back problems. For the longest time, they couldn't even march at their own marches because they had to sit in chairs because they couldn't walk for that long. They couldn't stand without their back hurting. And the sheriff's department, just it was ridiculous with how they treat our kids. And now just the other day, they did it again. We had a group of kids, five kids, leading the march on Tuesday, I believe it was, and on their way from walking from the district attorney's office where we were at to the mall, the kids were harassed, and three of the young girls, they now have sprained wrists, and their bodies are hurting them.
Now, I want to be sure that people understand this, that, you know, when Andy Lopez was killed, he was walking along carrying a toy gun. The cop that went after him was actually, there's been reports that he's involved in various, you know, reactionary organizations of all kinds. He's also a veteran of the Iraq War. And when he's pulled up on Andy, he pulled up on him and he just moved so fast. It was, and I think a generous level of time or amount of time is to say this, is it was all over within 26 seconds. And that's a generous estimate from what I read. It went anywhere from 19 seconds to 26 seconds. Eight shots he fired, one that missed Andy, seven that pounded into Andy's middle school body. All right. And this is a horrible outrage. And the other day, the DA just exonerated this cop, said, he was in fear for his life. He acted right. He did this. And then they turned around, and I thought Andy's father issued a statement at one point that said, once again, they not only, you know, let this go, they did it, they let it go, they murdered him once, and now they've murdered him again, including by putting out the idea that somehow Andy was responsible for what happened to him himself. And that was something that I thought was just completely outrageous. And it's important for people to understand that this is what these kids and what people like Nicole are going up against as they step out to fight this. Nicole, you have any, we're sort of moving along quickly here, but I wanted to know if you have anything you want to leave people with in terms of a message. I mean, even what you think of this DA's report and the murdering Andy a second time.
I think it's absolutely ridiculous that she can let him walk free when he even wrote in one of his articles how to react if you come across somebody with a BB gun. In this statement, he wrote his own defense ahead of time. He wrote, all you need to do is say you are in fear for your life. Mm-hmm. That was his good statement that was written, that he wrote in a guns magazine prior to killing Andy. And it basically was saying how to get away with murder.
Right.
To say you fear life. And that's exactly what he did. And it's ridiculous. He will be held accountable in one way or another. And, you know, the community, we're not going to give up. We're not going to stop. Andy did not deserve to die.
All right. At that note, I'm going to have to wrap this up. But stay in touch with us because I do want to follow this. This is extremely important, I think. So let's stay in touch, okay? Okay, and if anybody wants to find out more about what Andy's youth and others are up to in the fight for justice for Andy Lopez, you can do so at justicecoalitionforandy.com. That's justicecoalitionforandy.com, all right? And I'll have the link on my Facebook page if anybody wants to look that up. All right, Nicole, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay, take care now. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with, we're going to be talking with Lupillo Rivera, the Mexican-American musician who took a very bold, very brave, and very needed stand against the howling fascist mobs out in Murrieta last week. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this.
Ahora sí, ya me voy, ahí nos vemos. La frontera, me voy a cruzar. Voy buscando encontrar mi camino. voy buscando una oportunidad. Sé que voy a encontrar mil problemas. Sé que voy a tener que luchar. Pero vale el esfuerzo, la pena, porque sé que lo voy a lograr.
All right, welcome back. And that was El Tri with their song El Muro, and that's The Wall, which is, it's a song about the wall that was being constructed along the Mexican-American border, and it's about the lives of the people and the people themselves who are being forced to try and cross that border and what happens to them in the process. I had El Tri on the show a number of years back, and we talked about that song when it came out, and I thought of it in relation to my next guest, Lupillo Rivera, and he's a Mexican music superstar, and he also is now known for fighting anti-immigrant protesters in Murrieta. And he's fighting in the political sense, really standing up to them and saying, no, this is not going to be allowed to continue, okay? And believe me, folks, it was he confronted a mob of American flag-waving thugs. They were demonstrating against immigrant children who were being bused to a local border patrol station. And after being yelled at by these racist protesters, Lupillo, who is a superstar in Mexico, as I said, came back with a homemade sign and a group of friends and went right up in their patriotic, thuggish faces. Lupillo, welcome to the show.
How you doing? It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, good, man, good. Well, let's talk about this. You saw this. Tell me how this unfolded. You saw this. What did you think, and why were you so motivated to act?
The thing is that it all started with me passing by in a Raptor, like a truck that, you know, is not, I was confused for being an illegal immigrant in a passing truck, you know what I mean? And that's when I realized it's not, for their minds, it wasn't the issue about the kids. It was more like a racial issue. So the fact that being confused in a truck of a 2014 truck and a Raptor, you know, it doesn't make sense to me. That's when I came back, made my own signs, brought my wife along with me and my two children, and we started protesting against what they were trying to do. By the time I got back, the three buses were already there, and they were actually blocking the road so the buses wouldn't enter the immigration office. And the police was not doing nothing to the protesters for blocking the street, like, you know, just blocking the right-of-way of the street. By the time I got there, you know, that's when I got in their face and I started telling them that, you know, that it was wrong to kick children out of anywhere. It doesn't matter where they're coming from. Children are children, and I believe that they deserve their innocence to be respected. And, I mean, I can't say much about how they got here and who let them come out here, but they're here. And I think that our responsibility as fellow Americans is to help out the children that are here. And if we are going to deport them out of the country, I think we should deport them straight to the country where they came from, not to just next door country where everything's totally different for them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, really, when you think about this, it's really interesting, too, because here these people are talking about, and I saw this thing where they were yelling at one group of people saying, go back to where you came from, go back to where you came from. And they were talking to a group of Pima Indians. Who actually? Yeah, and
right.
Then
they're here, right?
Right, and then they're yelling about people. Don't cross the border! Don't cross the border! Well, you know, the irony of we're standing in what not all that long ago in historic time used to be Mexico, was stolen from Mexico. So who actually crossed what border to do what? You know, that's a question. And one of the things I kept thinking about too is the way they keep posing this. It's like these people are coming just for whatever reason they're coming because they want to take advantage of what we have to offer here. And you think about the story I just had with Andy Lopez, a 13-year-old Latino who was just gunned down by this sheriff for walking on the street with a toy gun. And then you have these children who aren't coming because, and their families aren't allowing them to come because they just think, oh, well, we just want to, you know, we just want to, for the hell of it, we can do it, we'll do it. These countries that people are coming from, like many countries around the world, have been so screwed over by this country in terms of what it does to people. I know you've seen this. You play a lot of music. You have a lot of ties with Mexico. You know, you've seen what happened to Mexico during NAFTA. You know, we're suddenly, all of these campesinos were ruined, were destroyed, no way to live because suddenly NAFTA changed all the terms. And this is what actually ends up happening with people in these countries. And so, yeah, people come here to survive. And I thought that was really something that you actually went up in people's face and you said, look, what are people doing when they come here? Who are these people that are here? What are they doing that's hurting you?
Correct. I believe that the people that come here to this country, it doesn't matter if they're Mexican, if they're Central American, South American, Asian, or Russian. They all come to this beautiful country that gives them the opportunity to grow, the opportunity to have a better life. They come here to work. 90% of those people that come to this country come here to work. There is a 10% of people that come and do things that are not supposed to be done, but 90% of them come in here to, you know, to clean their hotels, to babysit, to do jobs that most young people here in America don't want to do. You know, there's most young Americans don't want to be mowing lawns, and they don't want to be cleaning hotels, and they don't want to be working at as cooks at these restaurants, all these big chains. And that's what the facts are. You know what I mean?
Tell me something, Lupia, because this is we're running up on our time, but I wanted to know, again, you're not somebody who's known for like a lot of out front political activism or, you know, frankly, even in your music, but you're somebody who clearly has a heart with the people. And I was wondering about that in terms of what you thought when you came back to that place and you didn't just come back and hold up a sign, but you really ended up having to get into it with a lot of people. And I think, you know, it's interesting when I let people know that you were going to be on the show, so many people wanted to tune in and hear why you did what you did. And do you plan to continue to stand up against these fascist mobs and for these children and other immigrants? And do you think other people should actually be out there with you?
I think it's our responsibility as fellow Americans to be out there. I don't think it's right that a child comes into our country and we just kind of sign them off and turn our back to them. I can't do that. If some child comes to my house and asks me for a piece of bread, I'm not, you know, going to tell them, go next door. I'm going to tell them, look, here's a sandwich. You know, let's talk where you came from and let's fix you up. I think that's the most beautiful way to act with a child and with a lady, even with a mother. Males, you know, us males, we could defend ourselves. We could find a way out, right? But I think that, like I've said all this time, I'm not an activist. I'm not a leader. I'm just basically a normal human being with a heart trying to do the right thing. And when something is done wrong, you know, I go out there and defend myself and defend others' people's rights. It's the same thing as you could almost compare it with, like, a lady out on the freeway with a flat tire. I'll pull over and fix her tire. You know, if it's a guy, then, hey, you know, he can handle it. He's a guy. But, you know, if you see a child and their kid and their mother that can't handle a situation, I think it's our responsibility to stand up for them, especially if they're Latin or if they're U.S. illegals or whatever the case may be. You know, those are my feelings. And I don't know how far this situation is going to take me, because this situation came to me, and it's going to take me, because I can't sit here and tell you, yeah, I'm an activist, I'm the leader, and all that. I can't sit there and tell you, because I'm really not, you know. That's all I can say.
But you did act with your heart about what you know is right and what you know is wrong. And damn, Lupio, the world needs more people to be doing that right now. Lupio, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay, take care now, man. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Lupio Rivera about his standing up against the howling fascist mobs in Murrieta last week. All right, and as we get ready to wrap the show up, there's something I wanted to read from Bob Avakian's book, Basics, and it's the fourth chapter, the 30th quote, and it's something that has to do with pretty much has to do with the entire show, although it focuses up on the earlier part of the show, the first part of the show, and the idea of people exploring, you know, the world and how it is and how it got there and all this stuff. So check this out. People look at what religion calls the heavens. They look at the stars, the galaxies. They can see a small part of the vastness of the universe, and they can imagine the greater vastness of the universe. Or they can look on a small scale. Look with a microscope and see a small microbe or whatever, and be amazed by what goes on internally within that. They can ponder the relation between what you can see with a microscope and what you can see with a telescope. This is an essential quality of human beings. Human beings will always strive for this. Far from trying to suppress this or failing to recognize it, we can and should and will give much fuller expression to it. communism will not put an end to, nor somehow involve the suppression of, awe and wonder, the imagination, and the need to be amazed. On the contrary, it will give much greater and increasing scope to this. It will give flight on a much grander scale to the imagination, in dialectical relation with, and in an overall sense a part of, a systematic and comprehensive scientific outlook and method for comprehending and transforming reality. All right, and that piece is taken from Bob Avakian's book, Basics, and Avakian is the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And if you want to find out more about Avakian and his work, you can go to revcom.us. Again, that's revcom, R-E-V-C-O-M.us. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show. I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank all of my guests, Mark Levinson and David Kaplan, who are the director and producers of the film Particle Fever, Nicole Guerra from Andy's Youth, the group of youth that got together to fight for justice for their friend, 13-year-old Andy Lopez, who was brutally murdered by the Sonoma County Police back in the end of 2013. The Sonoma County DA recently exonerated the police for the murder, saying that they were only defending their lives from a 13-year-old boy with a toy gun. And I also want to thank Lupia Rivera, our last guest we just finished listening to, the musician who stood up to a fascist mob, verbally and physically assaulting a bus full of immigrant children as they were being processed in by the Border Patrol at a Border Patrol station in Murrieta, California, just a couple weeks ago. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And we're going to go out now with a song that I think is very appropriate for the entire theme of today's show, and it's called My Blood, and it's from the Neville Brothers. Check this out.
My blood.